Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus Chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunchberries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. It's John LaFoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunchberry.
No!
No one steals my Crunchberries.
I think you mean my Crunchberries. Choose your own Crunchventure with Cap'n Crunch.
Ah, the sweet sound of sports you love from Sling. The collide of football pads. The squeak of shoes on a basketball court. The crack of the bat on a home run. The slice of skates cutting across the ice. But what about this one? That's the sound of all the sports you love, all at once. Starting at $40 a month. Experience it all live with Sling.
Sling.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Schiller. Final stop on my month-long trip, and I'm recording in a hotel room in Hong Kong. We're leaving to come back to Berlin tonight, so you'll have me on a proper microphone again soon. There's also a fan whirring away in the background that I can't seem to turn off. It's annoying me, as it may be annoying you as much, so I do apologize for that, but hopefully I'll be able to filter it out. And you won't even know what I'm talking about, which would be ideal. Packed show this week. I have quite a few links I want to share with you. And then an interview with Hayden Barnes of Whitewater and Penguin. A new Linux distribution optimized for the Windows Linux subsystem, which is a very technical topic. Any of you who are Windows users or Linux users and know about Microsoft's efforts to include Linux runtimes in Windows now. This company have just released Penguin, a version of Linux optimized for running under Windows. And it was quite interesting. It's got some interesting features, some useful features, and I had a chat with Hayden about that and some other things. And I will have a hands-on with Penguin itself soon. I have to wait till I get home and have my Windows machine to be able to do that. So soon, I promise. But let's get on to the links. First up, not a new article, but an old one from 2017 on the NN/G Nielsen Norman Group website, blog. I'm not entirely sure what they call it. From Cara Perenis on the F-shaped pattern of reading. I was doing some research on this pattern recently. I think it was sparked from a talk I saw at the Write the Docs in Prague last year, so I'm always a bit behind. And this is a pattern that was kind of popularized in about 2006 by Nielsen Norman, actually. This way that people tend to read articles on the web. This F shape refers to how people tend to scan headlines and then subheadlines and then bits of structure and just wave their eyes around and attempting to make your content match that pattern. This is an article from 2 years ago saying that this pattern is probably misunderstood. Maybe it's overrated. Maybe it's not so relevant. And this is something I'm interested in digging more into to see if now our ways we read online content have changed. There's also some discussion on the Z-shaped pattern instead. You can kind of imagine what that would look like. Or is it that web pages have been built so much to match with this pattern that people have kind of stopped following it? It's interesting. But the article actually says it's still relevant and even more so on mobile these days. And especially, I guess, when you factor in responsive design, the way that people maybe used to read on a desktop doesn't necessarily match on mobile because the layouts change quite a bit. But if you don't know what the F-shaped pattern is and you work on content-heavy web pages, then I recommend the article to get up to speed on what that means. But then also some very good tips right at the bottom, 8 tips at the bottom of the article on how to, how to shape your content to match that pattern. Next, on the subject of, I guess, F-shaped patterns and successful web content, another article from Neiman, but this time from Neiman Lab, from Joshua Benton. This is one from the past couple of weeks. This is a post called "The Guardian Actually Makes Money Now." You may or may not know that The Guardian has not actually had a profitable year since 97, 98, I think they say. And finally, last year, they actually made money again. Not a tremendous amount, but enough. They made money. They made an operating profit. I have found The Guardian quite interesting for some time. I mean, it's operated by a foundation. It kind of has a mission to deliver content. They don't have a traditional paywall. They rely mostly on memberships and selective advertising. They were very, very early supporters of online media and online journalism and somehow managed to make it work for them, despite not having a paywall. But the interesting thing I find is that when I was younger, living in the UK, The Guardian was somewhat of a joke. It used to be called The Gurnead because it was so full of typos and spelling errors. And somehow it has turned itself around. I'm guessing probably since that period of the late 90s, that's probably what I'm remembering. Actually, maybe a little bit before. Satirical magazines like The Private Eye would actually have this column called The Gurnead, where they would look intentionally for errors in The Guardian. That's how infamous it was for it. I would like to know if The Private Eye still has that column, actually. So this is an interesting breakdown of how they have done this. Some of this has sadly involved cutting costs. They have laid off staff multiple times. We do have friends who work for The Guardian, and they don't pay massively well. You can get dumped pretty quickly. So there is a cost, of course, to this cost cutting, human cost typically. But that said, the journalism has remained reasonably top quality. I guess there are still enough people who are out there who are willing to do well-researched, well-founded, well-balanced pieces, even if it means they don't get paid so well. That is often the problem with people who are willing to do the right thing, and they will be taken advantage of ever so slightly. And The Guardian has obviously broken a lot of big, important stories over the past few years and has expanded into international editions. The Guardian in Australia was a breath of fresh air to Australia's very, very myopic or biopic, I'm not sure if that's the right word, view on the world, with basically two main media companies who run most of the local and national media. So having one additional new voice is also the Saturday paper, which is much smaller, to give a more independent perspective, was very welcome, and that has been very popular there. And it always was popular even before the international edition. So again, if you are spruiking up on your F-shaped reading pattern and want to see how maybe you could actually make some money out of your online content in the long-term future, then have another read of this post on Neiman Lab to get some ideas about some tactics you could try. And next is an article from 10 years ago, from 2009, by Edward Carr from the 1843 magazine, which is an Economist publication, called The Last Days of the Polymath. This was in preparation for a recording for the second episode I'm going to be doing for my enthusiastic amateur podcast, so you can listen out for more of that soon. About a particular person called Carl DeGerassi, not sure if that's how you pronounce it, talking about polymaths, and a lot of people saying that polymaths don't really exist anymore. I don't know if this is really true. It's hard to really say. I think, and you have to be very specific here. And this is what this article is kind of about: separating, I suppose, people who maintain a constant broad series of interests without ever digging deep into things, which kind of describes me a little bit, versus people who dig really deep into a topic, learn it very thoroughly, and then dig deep into another topic. So they get to know multiple topics, but they do one at a time, as opposed to kind of lightly diving into multiple. And there's a lot of people who kind of match this description in history. People like also Norman Mailer, Philip Roth, Gore Vidal, who are mentioned in this article too, and famous historical ones would be people like Darwin, even Lord Byron, these sorts of people who, and Leonardo da Vinci is a classic one as well, these people who seem to have accomplished so much with their lives, and kind of arguing that this doesn't happen so much anymore. And why is that? Is it something to do with the modern world? Is it something to do with sort of distractions in the modern world? Is it pressures of the way we have to live our lives now? Why is that? And again, I would point out, I'm not even 100% sure if I agree, but it's an interesting and fairly lengthy post about some of these people who the writer considers were the last polymaths of our kind of era and our generation, and some interesting examples from history. And yeah, whether you agree or not, I'm not 100% sure. I think the pressures of social security systems have increased pressure on this. For example, the article poses that somewhere like France tends to highlight public intellectuals more than countries like America or Britain. So it's harder for people just to kind of make a living or make a life out of just pontificating, I suppose, in certain countries over others. Obviously, it also helps if you come from rich families or something like that. Not all of them do. There are certainly people who manage to become knowledgeable in many, many areas without coming from rich backgrounds. I think Einstein, I think, is one of these classic examples of that, although I'm not sure if he was a polymath, but maybe you get my point. And university systems these days don't really encourage people to have these broad thoughts anymore. They want specializations. They want kind of degrees and qualifications that can be commercialized. And especially in subjects like philosophy and art, that's not always possible. But sometimes the best ideas can come from the sort of just thinking a lot and letting ideas collide. There's also some criticism in this article of polymaths. I'm not sure what the kind of collective word is, because all I can think of saying is polyamory, which is not quite the same, of course. So polymathery, I'm not sure what the actual word should be. From Mensa, the British kind of club for intellectuals, shall we say, their chairman is very dismissive of polymaths, saying that you have to specialize. And I think maybe the book by Malcolm Gladwell, where he talks about this 10,000 hour rule, which is controversial in itself now, sort of dismisses that it's possible to be a good polymath. I'm not sure. It's very very interesting to know whether there is space for it in the world anymore, and how you could survive, how you could survive financially, how you could have your knowledge and your ideas accepted, etc., etc. Obviously, there's space for everyone to have an opinion these days, but The modern habits make it quite hard to be very, very dedicated to a particular topic all the time. It's an interesting article, and it's a subject I will dive a lot more into in this forthcoming interview, which I will keep you up to date when that is released. On the subject of people who are very singly focused, there's another article here from Nautilus magazine by Amanda Gefter, the man who tried to redeem the world with logic. And this was a really interesting post to me, because it feeds into the early stories of computing. This is about someone called Walter Pitts from the 1930s, 1940s America. Again, kind of feeding into what we were talking about. He was brought up in a poor family in Detroit. And he was a logistician, basically. Anyone who's even studied basic mathematics relating to computing knows that logic is a very fundamental part of it. Things like if-else statements, if this, do this, if that, do that. Things like loops, do this whilst this is true, etc., etc. These are very basic constructs to computing. But these theories had to come from somewhere, and this was feeding off a lot of the practice from people like Turing during the war, who obviously kind of invented some of the first computers, but these computers were very slow because they were not very efficient at running repeated tasks, and repeated tasks require things like logic and loops. And Pitts, along with a handful of other people, Warren McCulloch and a handful of others, were kind of the people to start theorizing on this and attempt to put it into at least mathematical practice, not necessarily into programming language practice, but lay the ground rules for how this work would be. And this also brought in a potentially more well-known person to the computing industry, that of John von Neumann, who, if you read his Wikipedia page, is also described as a polymath. See, I do have some running themes here sometimes. Originally from Budapest in the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. There's a lot of von Neumann architecture is used a lot. He's also one of the early proponents of quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, self-replicating machines. I do know this name for when I studied computer science. He's a very, very influential figure. And Pitt worked with him and some others, all at MIT, of course, kind of, well, I guess still the preeminent seat for computer science research. This article is sort of a hard read. It's one of these typical stories of frustration from these sorts of people who are very driven and very maybe socially awkward and want to solve a problem with such dedication that they kind of lose the families around them and friends, and things, despite this sort of social awkwardness, can get very emotional and people can fall out very easily about the smallest things. This was also post-prohibition, so ironically alcoholism became a bit of an issue. They would work late into the night drinking whilst coming up with these fundamental ideas of computing. And so it's a fairly sad article, and he actually ends his life kind of, you know, not particularly positively, shall we say. He basically became, in the late 60s, pretty full-on alcoholic. He had delirium tremors. He decided, after years of working on his PhD, which people are now only just starting to reassemble, people have kind of known his impact on computer science, but without ever having any sort of proof of it, because he set fire to his PhD after many years of working on it, because he just... Yeah, I think probably these days we would describe him as being on the Asperger's scale. He spent his life trying to follow the logic that he was trying to formulate so much, and that's not how the world really works, that it got very frustrated. I think we see people like this a lot in the computing industry, but it was not necessarily understood so much then. And he died alone in a boarding house in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the late 60s. McCulloch also then died 4 months later. So all these kind of early names that were responsible for creating a lot of the underpinnings of modern computing logic, the fundamentals of any programming language these days, are not forgotten, but did not exactly end their lives in very positive ways. Much of their own causation, unfortunately. It's a sad article, but certainly very interesting to understand some of the thought processes that went into these theories that are now a fundamental of computer programming. Not the most happy story, unfortunately. But if that topic is of interest to you, if you understand the importance of these ideas, it's interesting to get some insights into the origin stories. I won't say enjoy, but certainly become intrigued. Next, a post from the GitHub blog by Brian Clark, although this was widely repurposed and reported in a series of tech blogs around the webosphere. Apache Software Foundation joins GitHub open source community. This is interesting. Apache is obviously, the Apache Software Data Foundation is obviously a big software foundation that hosts many, 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 many important open source projects. But up until a few months back, they were not officially on GitHub. They maintained their own repositories. And this is controversial because GitHub, despite its key role in open source software, is not actually open source itself. It's a proprietary commercial product now owned by Microsoft. Microsoft are not the company they used to be, but still, they are Microsoft. They still make one of the, or a handful of the most successful proprietary applications in the world, despite their positive moves towards embracing open source. That is still how they make money. So a lot of the Apache Software Foundation community are not particularly happy about this decision. This has been in progress for quite some time. They have been trialing it and testing it and doing prototypes and kind of dual pushing to repositories, I guess. But still, now everything is officially there. And of course, this means that these projects get more exposure to potential developers. This is one of the reasons to move to GitHub. I have tried putting repositories on GitLab out of interest, and GitLab even lacks the discovery ability that you have with GitHub. You do not get kind of random drive-by commits to projects really anywhere else apart from GitHub. This is why people put projects there. I would assume that many people who want to commit to Apache projects will go looking for them, but there are smaller Apache projects that are not so known, so people will find those. So this blog post, of course, is a product announcement, so it's mostly positive. You can do some internet searching around the topic to get some of the more divided opinions, but interesting times. Microsoft now kind of has interests in, ironically, a lot of the applications that in years gone by they described as a cancer. Now they kind of maintain the very resources that they run on, which is quite fascinating. And who knows, the paranoid amongst us might wonder if this is all part of the plan, but who knows. And finally, in the and finally section, this was an article that took me by surprise. And it especially took me by surprise because it maybe made me realize that my own decisions are not the best ones. This was an article on Wired by Katia Moscovich called "Turns Out Coffee Pods Are Actually Pretty Good for the Environment." This surprised me no end because we have generally assumed that coffee pods are bad for the environment because of all the waste. But turns out this may or may not be true. This is, of course, always, it depends. It depends on whose coffee pods, how they're made, etc., etc. For example, the Nespresso ones tend to be better to recycle, but they use a proprietary design. And to recycle them, Nespresso have to recycle them. So, you know, you have to kind of follow their pathways to be recyclable, which may or may not be possible. And some of the reasoning behind why this may or may not be true is basically around waste. So, for example, instant coffee is the best. It may not taste the best, but you basically put a spoonful in, you add some hot water, and you're done. There is no waste from instant coffee. The process of making the instant coffee can vary, of course. And again, that somewhat depends on who's making it and how it's made. But overall, instant coffee is the best. Annoyingly, and this is where I start to wonder about my own life choices, filter and drip coffee are the worst. because there is waste. I often put hot water in that I don't need. I throw the ground maybe down the sink, maybe in the bin. I rinse the plunger, etc., etc. You start to see what is happening here. I often heat too much hot water for more than I need, etc. And then traditional espresso in machines is the worst, which probably will not surprise you because they're big machines. Especially if even you look in a cafe, you see a lot of waste in steam and overflow and things like that. With pods second on that list. And this is because capsules tend to use less coffee. This was why I would argue is why they don't taste very good, because I find them too weak. And the predominant impact on the environment for coffee is when the coffee is grown. So obviously, if you use less of it, then there's less impact. As I mentioned earlier, of course, it always depends. So if you do use drip filter coffee efficiently and effectively, then it isn't so bad. But how many people actually do that, I guess, is the thing. And it'd be the same with making tea, I suppose. If you boil a full kettle for one cup of tea, it's the same problem. So it all comes into just being as effective as you can. Put your coffee grounds in compost, etc., etc. Don't rinse it every time. Just leave a little bit of dry coffee in there between use, etc., etc. So interesting. And as always, it depends. But the actual waste of these pods may or may not be as bad as we initially thought. It very much depends what they're made from as well. And actually, ironically, some of the ones that claim to be the most renewable aren't necessarily, because you can't necessarily make them out of something completely biodegradable, because they might biodegrade in storage and in transit. And if you make them fully from aluminium, they can be partially recyclable. Some have plastic and aluminium lids, etc., etc., etc. So it really can depend. So do your research if this is important to you. But yes, Nespresso and various rip-off brands can be smug in their knowledge that while you may not be drinking the best coffee, you may be having a better impact on the environment than all of us coffee snobs initially accused you of. That was my links for the week. And next is my interview with Hayden Barnes of Penguin, talking about their Windows subsystem for Linux, optimized version of Linux. Enjoy.
I'm Hayden, and I created WLinux and the startup around it named Whitewater Foundry. WLinux is now Penguin, and it is the first Linux distribution built on and for Windows subsystem for Linux.
Before we dive into more details of what that means, maybe let's clarify for people who don't know, what is the Windows subsystem for Linux?
Okay. The Windows subsystem for Linux is a translation layer that is built into Windows. It's an optional feature that ships in every version of Windows. And it is similar in some ways to the more popular project Wine. Mm. Folks may know Wine as a tool to run Windows applications on Linux, Mac OS, FreeBSD. And what Wine does is a re-implementation of the Windows API, the graphics API, those Windows calls. Hmm. WSL is a little lower level than that. In fact, it doesn't implement Linux APIs. It implements individual Linux system calls. So it is the low-level calls that go between the applications and their libraries to the kernel. Those are intercepted by a driver layer that translates them on the fly into NT system calls. Mm-hmm. Windows and Linux were both built for the x86 platform. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of cases, those system calls are very similar. A few require some translation and a few have to be implemented. But thanks to Linus's don't break user space, the longstanding policy, the system calls are fairly stable. And the WSL team at Microsoft have achieved probably 95 to 99% compatibility mm-hmm. with the Linux binaries. So you run those Linux binaries on the console or in a GUI natively on Windows. And you install those and manage the dependencies with a package manager from your choice of Linux distribution, which you can install from the Microsoft Store or sideload build from source. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it's a platform to run the Linux console, a bash, or other script or other, command line shell. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also supports GUI. If you run an X server it's designed for developers, yeah. But we've seen a huge uptick among system administrators, power users, people focused on productivity. You can get so much more done on the command line than in a in a GUI. So
we'll come back to the GUI aspect in a minute, because Penguin is doing something interesting on that front. Because at the moment, I have experimented with it. I am primarily a Mac user, but I do have a Windows machine as well for testing things, and Linux on the same machine.
Yeah,
Up until recently, it had Ubuntu and SUSE available kind of officially, in quote marks. And I guess, as you already said, others available from source. I'm not sure if Red Hat or Fedora was in there as well.
So there's Debian. There's Ubuntu 16.04, 18.04, SUSE, OpenSUSE, and SUSE Enterprise. Mm-hmm. There is now a Fedora distro, Fedora-based distro that we sponsor. There's not an official Fedora distro, but we have a Fedora-based distro we sponsor. Mm-hmm. Penguin is based on Debian testing, unlike the other one. So you get more modern packages versus the standard Debian. Yeah. And then we have Penguin Enterprise, and that's designed for the enterprise environment. You can download a demo from the store that's built with Scientific Linux, but it is our custom package to deploy RHEL or Oracle Linux for our enterprise customers in-house. So that's not generally available. But those customers can contact us. But it's funny you mentioned you are a Mac user, because so was I. You know, I actually worked at Apple.
I've been thinking I am slowly thinking of switching, and this is half the reason I'm interested in this subject, because Linux doesn't have quite enough graphical applications. Windows isn't quite good enough for development for the things I need. So it's an interesting compromise. But I hit a few problems, which I think Penguin may have solved. We'll come to in a minute. But so what, I mean, was yours a similar journey there?
Well, you know, there's no perfect operating system. No. Every operating system has trade-offs. You know, and every operating system, you know, either Linux, Windows, or Mac OS is in this weird in-between phase where, you know, there's still these old parts, and then there's new parts coming in, and they don't exactly match. You know, you've got, on Mac OS, you've got the standard Cocoa Carbon apps, and then you've got Marzipan coming in. With Windows 10, you've still got those old Win32 components left over from Windows 7, right next to, you know, these beautiful UWP apps. And don't even get me started about fragmentation on Linux desktop.
Oh, no, the desktop, it's a nightmare, yeah.
But, you know, for some people, running Linux on Windows makes sense.
Yep.
And I used Mac OS for a long time because it gave me that balance of a Nix terminal with consumer grade GUI apps like Office and the, you know, support. And what happened, you know, Apple came out with their new MacBook Pros, you know, and I had bought a new MacBook Pro every other year for probably a decade. And I just couldn't bring myself. I'm like, you know, the price went up, their keyboard problems, the touch bar didn't make any sense to me. And I'm just like, I'm just not feeling this Apple hardware anymore. And my friends are said, you know, get a ThinkPad. I'm like, ThinkPad, what year is it? And
it's a Lenovo ThinkPad. That's what year it is.
And exactly. And I went to the Apple store and I tried that keyboard and I'm like, no. And then I went and I tried a ThinkPad keyboard, and man, it is just a viscerally pleasing experience to type on this keyboard. Now, especially now that I have mechanical keyboards and have kind of like, it's a nice in between. And I tried desktop Linux, you know, for several weeks, and it was fine. It was fine. I could do most of my work just fine. But but coming over to Windows and running Linux and Windows side by side really kind of unlocked everything I was looking for my use case. And
let's just before we. Firstly, before we turn into another Apple rant podcast, which there have been quite a few, before we get really into Penguin, I just want to cover one more thing you said earlier, which I had actually thought about the comparison, because I always thought about them as very different projects and always kind of a compromise. You mentioned Wine earlier, And I do remember trying that, especially on the, especially for running Windows applications on Linux. And most of the time it didn't really work, to be honest with you. So, I mean, do you consider them a fair comparison? I guess that was unofficially supported. The subsystem is officially supported. Is Wine still likely to continue with development, or do you think this is more of a the path now for the future?
I hope Wine continues development. In fact, some of our contributors are also contributors to the Wine project. Wine, I mean, there's technical differences. Wine implements an API. WSL implements a syscall translation layer. Wine is more of a community project sponsored by code weavers. You know, WSL Microsoft and, you know, has support, including Windows Server and long-term service branch. So it's different ways to get at the, you know, it's kind of like hyper, you know, we're almost competing internally with Hyper-V on Windows. So what we're seeing is a blurring of these operating systems. I mean, even on a practical level, the first operating system your Intel computer boots is Minix on the IME built into the hardware, which, you know, loads the boot system and the internal chipset, and then you boot Windows, and then you boot Linux if you're using WSL. So the idea of basically all of these operating systems becoming kind of runtimes is coming to fruition.
I guess effectively for developers, especially, you're almost also competing with things like Docker as well. But obviously, it's very transient. You lose state usually. That's kind of how it's designed anyway.
We're in that cloud. We're kind of on a spectrum between Docker and VirtualBox and Hyper-V. We can't ignore Cygwin, you know, which is classic project. Even older projects like Unix Services for Windows, which was officially supported by Microsoft, or Co-Linux, which was a project back in the day that booted a Linux kernel inside Windows. So we see ourselves as part of this tradition and this new movement here. It's funny because the base technology, of course, it's evolved significantly since then, but the original use for WSL was actually an attempt to run Android apps on Windows Phone to close the app gap on Windows Phone. and there was actually an insider version of Windows Phone that shipped that falls off trucks online sometimes that you can find and install on an old Lumia if you have one, run. But, you know, I've always been a operating system fan, you know, using different operating systems, you know, merging them. And this just was right up my alley.
Yeah. Well, so I have experimented a little bit with the subsystem in the past because, my experiments with attempting to use a Windows machine instead of my Mac and hitting those barriers with trying to do some open source development and just finding that on Windows it was still very confusing. Things like you very easily on Windows end up with multiple shells and you don't really know what's installed where. You're more familiar with Bash than PowerShell, so then you end up with PowerShell and Bash and then it gets a little confusing. So the subsystem seemed like an interesting, I don't want to say compromise, but an interesting option. But I ran into two issues, and looking down the Penguin feature list, I'm wondering if it solves them or not. And it has been a little bit of time a couple of months at least since I last really tried WSL. So maybe it's not Penguin solving these. Maybe it's updates to the subsystem that solve these. So one was one of your features you have works seamlessly between Windows and Linux. So I always remember that in the Linux subsystem, you can access Windows files relatively easily. You can find the Windows drives and access files and things like that. The aspect I was always trying to do, where I got stuck, was the other way around. trying to access Linux files within Windows. Is that now a possibility, or am I still stuck one way?
Yes. So you can now access it's coming in 19H1, which is the upcoming release of Windows.
Okay.
And in your quick access bar in File Explorer on the left, you will now see a Linux and Penguin, you know, a little Penguin logo with a drop down, and you'll be able to see your Linux installations and just go browse directly in File Explorer to your Linux files. Yeah. The workaround used to be running Samba inside WSL. or using SFFTP to move back and forth. But they've solved that, and they actually solved that using a file sharing protocol from Plan 9. So it's getting weird. It's getting fun.
Yeah.
But to actually take the Plan 9 file sharing components and use it to mesh Windows and Linux, and it works. So that's in current insider builds. I think it's even in the slow ring now. Okay. So,
and here's another, I have some very specific things I was trying to solve here. So this might seem like a very strange requirement, but do you know if Penguin or Windows, I guess the lines are getting a bit blurry on who provides what feature. Will it be possible to run any form of Linux executable in Windows directly? Crazy talk. So the use case I was trying to solve was I wanted to run a Linux application and let Visual Studio Code access it.
Okay.
I'm guessing that from your response is probably crazy talk still.
so you can set WSL as your default terminal in Visual Studio Code.
Okay. Okay.
So that's one way to get there.
Maybe. We'll see. I'll have to keep experimenting.
The second way is just to call penguin.exe with a you know, on the command prompt with an argument to run whatever command you need run in the subsystem.
Yeah.
So there's ways to get there.
Okay. I'll have to have another experiment when I get back. I'm on my Mac whilst we're traveling, so I'll have to wait till I get my Windows machine. Otherwise, I'll just have so many layers of virtualization. It'll be and the way you just described the sharing that's coming reminds me a little bit of I don't know if you ever use Parallels on the Mac. They do some reasonably nice work on making the experience more seamless. It's a commercial application, but you can even do things like use Mac services to, in quote marks, open a web page in Edge or Internet Explorer. Obviously, it has to boot Windows and all that kind of thing, but still.
Right.
But you see them kind of on your desktop.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
We package a set of tools with Penguin, and we make these available for the other WSL distros on our repo server called WSL Utilities. And one of those is WSL View.
So that's like Parallels Utilities. Yeah. Okay.
And WSL View, if you run it, will open that whatever file you're referring to or web page in Windows.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're running, a web app, you know, on WSL, and you just need to open it real quick from the command line in the new Chromium Edge, you just WSL View website, and it launches your website in Edge. So we're getting there. It's still early.
And the other barrier I hit was the area of GUIs. Now, you've already mentioned that, of course, when it comes to Linux, GUIs is not one thing. With Mac and Windows, it's still not quite one thing, but there's certainly less than Linux.
Yeah.
You know, you have so many windowing managers and so many GUI libraries for creating interfaces. It's always been a bit of an issue I found with Linux. Like, you have something beautifully designed like Elementary OS, but then as soon as you get out of their default applications, it just looks like something else. So it becomes very disconcerting very quickly.
Right.
Now, you do say in the feature list many Linux GUI applications.
Right.
But I'm still assuming that's going to be a limited list, and I'm guessing for resource reasons as well. That may be more limiting. Okay, so go back to my use case. Could I run Visual Studio Code for Linux in Penguin on Windows?
Yes. Okay. Now, to be fair, it breaks occasionally.
Sure.
But yes. Okay. So one of the ways we solve this, you know, you primarily on Linux have JTK and Qt, you know, Qt. So one of the things we do is if you use Penguin setup and go to the GUI section, we offer to just go ahead and install a base layer of GUI libraries, okay, the most common GUI libraries. And then we offer to install a unified JTK and Qt theme, either light or dark mode, to match Windows to the best of our abilities. The issues running GUI apps tend to be dependencies, you know, sometimes hard systemd dependencies, and graphics acceleration, because graphics acceleration currently isn't available on WSL.
Yep.
But in terms of running GNOME Builder, you know, several Genie is a very common, popular, Emacs, the GUI version, all of those are available and run just fine. So it's really focused on development tools.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I wouldn't run Steam on Linux. No.
I can't even get Steam to run in Windows on an emulator. So I wouldn't. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. And I guess, again, in the very near future, although at the moment, I suppose you still have that one-way sync as well. If I do a file open from that graphical application, I can access my Windows files as well.
Yep.
I mean, let's go crazy. Could I use something like OpenOffice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can run. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So just anything that isn't too graphic intensive, basic Office.
Anything that doesn't need 3D graphic acceleration. Okay. So if it's something that would benefit from an accelerator card, it's going to be slow.
Yeah.
But the thing is, WSL, when you load WSL, the translation layer is already running.
Okay.
So, and has a very minimal footprint. And when you launch Penguin, you're only launching Bash. So in terms of resources, you're using, I think, like nine megabytes of RAM.
Yeah.
So it's not so much a resource limitation. It's, you know, to be honest, right now it's a little bit of a file IO limitation, and that's because Windows Defender is active inside WSL. And if you have a, you know, compromised node module that's, you know, going to just, you know, has been hacked to mine Bitcoin, Defender will pick it up and block access to it. But I do know that the WSL team is working really hard on improving performance on file IO. Mm-hmm. But in terms of CPU, just pure CPU performance, some of the Phoronix benchmarks put WSL head-to-head, if not ahead of bare metal Linux. Mm-hmm,
And coming back, so this is mostly aimed at developers. I mean, I can't imagine who else would need to run Linux on a Windows machine, maybe some administrative stuff.
Sysadmins, developers, some students
maybe. I do remember having, but I went to uni a long time ago. So I think there was, I think this is even before Linux. So you also have this very useful Penguin setup tool for installing some fundamental kind of programming language runtimes, Python, Go, Ruby, Node, PowerShell, Azure, Cloud Tools, among others. So I'm guessing that's installing Debian packages, and is that installing the optimal Debian packages? I know, like, for example, Node is often not always up to date in some Linux packages and things like that. So are you running the default ones, or are you running optimized ones there?
We're running N, giving folks the option.
Okay.
So we what we're trying to do is just build the take the best in class of each tool chain and then give users a starting point. So in some cases, we use the Debian testing packages. And in some cases, we use, like for Ruby, we use RBENV other tools like that. And, you know, some of these you would install just like you would on a Linux machine. And then others need tweaks and workarounds to work correctly on WSL. And we just build those in. All of those optimizations are baked in.
And does that setup tool also, one of the other features you list is web servers and database servers. Does that tool also help with those, or are they separate things like Apache and MySQL?
So we are working towards basically one-click LAMP stack that's coming.
Okay.
We currently offer an SSH server and the option to use rc.local to start services on launch. So you can now install Apache and add it to rc.local and have it launch on start. But we haven't fully fleshed that out completely yet.
Okay. And I guess relating a little bit to some of my earlier questions, if I install Node in Penguin and a whole bunch of NPM modules, et cetera, I could access those in Windows using some of the methods that you described earlier and remove probably like one of the many Node installations I may have on my Windows machine.
Yeah, you actually, we've run into some issues recently with Node on Windows in path conflicting with WSL because the path is shared. The path environment is shared in both. So sometimes if people will have multiple installations, it can cause issues, but we're working on it.
Okay. So you mentioned you have a kind of a default in quote marks version, which this may surprise, maybe a shock for open source people, but costs currently $10 on $9.99. $10 discount right now. So jump in. But you said you have an enterprise version as well. So what's the difference?
So the difference is the enterprise version is custom built for enterprise customers. So enterprise customers come to us. Sometimes they have air gap. They have air gap networks. They need specific Python tool chains. You know, depending on their deployment, a lot of them are using satellite and or spacewalk to manage. And the great thing is we can take their existing Windows and Linux endpoint infrastructure and merge them into a custom image for those customers. Now, we do make a demo build of Penguin Enterprise available in the store. We don't make a lot of noise about it. It's built with Scientific Linux, which is derived from CentOS. And it doesn't have nearly the optimization or the customization. I mean, it is very raw. It is meant for people who just really want to be able to run a CentOS distro on their on WSL.
Yep. Okay. And so as far as I can tell with Whitewater, this is mostly what you do. You also have this Fedora remix for WSL as well. So what's the history behind the company? When did you start working on Penguin and why, I guess?
So I started working on what was then WLinux. I had been experimenting with WSL after I made the switch to a ThinkPad and wanted to give WSL a shot. And I wanted to see what it could do. And I was installing lots of things and breaking lots of things and having to reset the app. And every time I reset the app, I had to go in and manually or eventually wrote a script that put all my WSL optimizations in place. Combine that with bugs I started encountering and documenting and reporting upstream to distros that will go unnamed. And basically we were told, we don't care. This is a limited, go tell Microsoft. Well, Microsoft isn't going to patch a bug in a distro package.
Well, so we decided maybe, but yeah, we'll see.
maybe. But, so it was a combination of wanting to experiment with WSL, break it, be able to reset it and have sane defaults out of the box, and then combine that with a community and support focused specifically on WSL. that put WSL users first, and that, you know, we actually built it in such a way that so that you can build Penguin on Penguin. It is a self-hosting operating system. So you can build the image and install it from itself. So it's not just a culling of Linux tools. You know, it is a functional distribution minus the kernel.
And I'm guessing that this is a relatively new project, but
yeah. So let me pick back up. Yeah. So that started, that was about 8-9 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I pushed that out, and I didn't think anyone would care, and I didn't think anyone would buy it. And it has been quite popular, and people have been willing to pay $10.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we quickly established a team of people who kind of gravitated to mm-hmm. the project. We hired them on. We then got approached by Enterprise, who mm-hmm. wanted to be able to run Rail-based Linux distros. So we developed the Penguin Enterprise solution for them. It's not its own distro. It's a package solution. Because they often need deployment consulting and service level mm-hmm. agreements. Mm-hmm. And then the Fedora community was missing a distro from the Microsoft Store. And there were legal issues that prevented that mm-hmm. from happening. And that, you know, may change in the future. You know, we kind of hope it does.
Mm-hmm.
But Fedora members of the Fedora community came to us and said, can you do this? And we said, yes, actually our software that runs WLinux, or then WLinux Enterprise, now Penguin Enterprise, runs Fedora, because Fedora is just upstream, right?
Mm.
So we packaged and make Fedora Remix for WSL available under the Fedora Remix program. It is not Fedora. It is Fedora Remix. You know, there's specific criteria we have to follow in order to use that special mark. And we make that available as a community service. It's less expensive, mm-hmm. and it's also available for other places online for free. So we don't make a lot of revenue on that one. That's more of a community service. But the reason, you know, you touched on something that's probably going to be of interest, is that the idea of paying for open source software. And I knew that would be controversial, but I remember when I started on Linux, you know, you would pay for it. You know, I paid $50 for my first version of Red Hat. I remember getting like an 11 CD set of SUSE from, you know, and you bought it and you got support for it.
Yeah.
And I think there's you know, once it became possible to easily download ISOs, to install, you know, yourself, it kind of, especially when Ubuntu started just mailing out
yeah.
CDs like AOL used to, the idea of getting a free, I'm aging myself, a free.
Oh, no, I remember it too. Don't worry.
distro. And I think the problem with that is that the people who pay for products are going to get their needs addressed first.
Mm.
Right now, the majority of people paying for Linux are enterprise, and they're paying for enterprise features, and you know, enterprise actually likes systemd. They do. Systemd is super easy, and that's why systemd is where it is, because enterprise likes it and paid for it, and they're the ones who are putting money into Linux distros. And there's a place for community and volunteer distros, but you know, you look at what Elementary is able to do with everything they do by having a pay what you want model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think open source, especially when it comes to maintaining projects over long periods of time, I think the idea of paying small sums of money or building from source for yourself is something that the open source community needs to move towards if we want tools that are made for us that aren't tied to big corporate platforms.
And don't die in 2 years or something like that as well.
Exactly. I think the first wave of open source were independent hackers.
Mm.
The second wave was enterprise. And I want to see the third wave be small projects who are willing, you know, who are brave enough to charge and say, we have a product here. You can look at the source, but if you want to buy into this community, this project, get support, form this kind of ongoing contract between the two of us, you're going to pay something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been pretty successful. We're able to hire four full-time, four devs. And for some of them, it's a side gig. For some of them, it's their full-time job.
Yeah.
It varies. We work out arrangements. And I tell people this, you come to the project and you contribute and you add value, we pay you. Mm. You know, you don't have to go through an obnoxious interview process.
Yeah. I think that's, it sounds like a very, I guess even with Windows, even a niche use case of Windows is still a very large user base. So,
you know, and something like 50% of Windows PCs are still running Windows 7. So we think we have a lot of upward, you know, trajectory in terms of pick up. And, you know, once WSO users find out about us, unless they have a specific reason to stick to what they're on, they tend to make the move because they know that they're, you know, investing in the platform. There's a company here and it's staffed and they're supporting other WSL hackers and upstream projects. So we put patches, you know, we've got bug reports and patches that go up into upstream projects. So, I mean, if you're demoing Fedora 30 beta, there's patches in there that, you know, that we help make happen. Mm-hmm. If you're running Windows, there's patches in there too. We work with everyone to make this work.
So the final question then on that trajectory with the team you have in place, what's on the roadmap for the next 6 months, say?
So we're going to continue. So we just deployed 1.2, which moved everyone from basically an update system based on GitHub to our own CI/CD, continuous improvement, continuous deployment app repo. Mm-hmm. So this has allowed us to basically put feature deployment in hyperdrive. Mm-hmm. And we are rolling out new features basically every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we are adding more and more features. We are going to build more capacity as Penguin Enterprise deployments pick up. Mm-hmm. Those are becoming, you know, we're getting approached by, you know, a lot of enterprise prefer Windows for their endpoints because they know how to lock it down.
Yeah.
And now they want to be able to lock down WSL too.
Yeah.
And we can provide that.
Yeah.
There's some other opportunities in the space that we're pursuing that you should watch our presentation at Microsoft Build to get a glimpse of. So we'll be there. We'll be talking cross-platform development and DevOps, and we'll be showing off things you can do. You know, we're going to build the same C app in Linux and Windows and show that you can run them side by side. We're going to deploy a container. We're going to write a Linux app. We're going to deploy it to the cloud. We're going to deploy it to Windows. We're going to deploy it to Linux, all from the same, you know, console.
Cool.
So we've got some cool demos coming up, and we might show off something at Build. We'll see.
You're going to be running Steam for Linux in no.
Oh, yeah, no, right. You know, and you know, admittedly, we're kind of in a tough spot because we're between these big corporate giants and building this community. And the good news is we have really great relationships with these teams, and you know, we work closely with their technical folks. We're knowledgeable about the roadmaps coming down the line, so. We can do things to really make this great. But if you're coming to Build, find us. We've got stickers. I don't know if this will be out before then. But you can also request a sticker on our website. So if you're interested in getting involved, We welcome that, helpful issues that you open on GitHub. You're welcome to do a drive-by commit. Those are welcome. If you want to get involved in the long term, you're more than welcome. So we need all the help we can get, you know, and it's open source that you can get paid to do.
That was my interview with Hayden Barnes. Hope you enjoyed that. It was an interesting discussion. We had a little bit of everything to please all podcast audiences in there. Open source, Apple bashing, computer history, everything that you could possibly need. If you've enjoyed the show, you can find previous episodes at christianjiller.com/podcast. You can also support the show at christianjiller.com/support. You can find my newsletters that accompany this podcast at christianjiller.com/newsletters. And you can also tweet at me at Chris Chinch. Please give me any feedback on any of those locations or in comments. Wherever you have found this podcast, please share if you've enjoyed. And until next time, when I will have an interview with Netlify as well for the next episode. If you have been, thank you very much for listening.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. He's Jean Lafoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last crunch berry.
No!
No one steals my crunch berries.
I think you mean my crunch berries. Choose your own crunch venture with Cap'n Crunch.
Once upon a time, three bears found a golden-haired guest who wouldn't leave their home.
This Dunkin' Cold is just right. Mm, and this Dunkin' Cold is just right.
Should we introduce ourselves?
No, Barry. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track. We care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.